Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Now, the Cannes Film Festival finished last weekend. Two of the movies on show were music documentaries. One was about the Velvet Underground, which I haven't seen. The other, called The Sparks Brothers, I have. Edgar Wright, who made movies like Shaun of the Dead and Baby Driver, is a fan of Sparks, and he's made a refreshingly unconventional, mischievous, fun-filled documentary about the Mayall brothers from California. So let me explain all that. Ron and Russell Mayall are the duo who call themselves Sparks. They've been on the go for 5 or 6 decades. They've released 25 albums, and the documentary is as whimsical, intelligent, subversive and endearingly zany as the duo's music. Every few years, Sparks reconfigured their theatrical brand of outsider rock in increasingly surprising ways, and there are no signs of slowing down. So before we meet Ron and Russell Mayall, let's take a listen to this here, their big 1970s hit which scared people on Top of the Pop sometimes. This is called This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us. I would assume that there is a possibility that you have been asked this question many times in the last few weeks, and I'm going to ask it now because it's one of the damn selling lines of the movie. So how would you answer the question, how can one rock band be successful, underrated, hugely influential, and criminally overlooked at the same time?
That's the $64 million question, or £64 million question or whatever. That was kind of one of the theses or the questions that Edgar Wright, the director of the Sparks Brothers, that he threw out there, and he felt that, you know, all of those things that the band has been hugely influential and hugely be overlooked in a, to a certain extent, and so he wanted to really rectify that situation, at least in his way, be able to have a document where he could hopefully, in his way, present Sparks to a bigger, broader audience, or a different audience in any case, that were his film fans. And so that's what he set out to do. He's been such a ardent supporter of Sparks and such a fan, and he felt all those things that you initially said, and he wants to in his small way try to rectify that.
Ron, he certainly didn't take a small approach. I mean, all the little animations and the strange sketches and the recreation scenes, etc., and all the videos and live stuff, etc., you know, there's so many different animation stuff too, in a variety of arresting styles. This is Edgar Wright who did this. But I mean, did you have any say in how he would put all these things together to make the 2 hours plus?
Not really, other than that we were incredibly pleased that it feels like an Edgar Wright film, and that when we first agreed to do it, it was Edgar Wright directing it, and we had no idea really what a documentary by Edgar Wright would look like. We were huge fans of his narrative films, and so we were just praying that this wouldn't be the one Edgar Wright film that was dull and boring. Because it was a documentary, but it has all the kind of kinetic all the energy and all of the kind of anything goes kind of attitude of a Edgar Wright film. So we kind of stayed out of all of those stylistic decisions, but we knew that there was kind of a kinship as far as our sensibility. So we felt really comfortable with the situation.
You felt really comfortable, but you must feel really happy too, just even over the last few weeks. I mean, dull and boring, you just said there. It is so the exact opposite. Everybody's pointing this out. It's getting thumbs up right across the board from everybody. It must make you feel damn good, does it?
Well, to be honest, it does. Yeah. No, we feel really, really good about the situation now. And it's odd that at this time, you know, especially for a band with a, you know, 25 album long history, can have something now where there's sort of this newfound embracing of Sparks, you know, in a general way. And so for us, it's just really satisfying, both the documentary from Edgar and also the other movie musical project that has just come out in France and will be opening soon at the end of the month in the UK, in Ireland, and so you know, it's just amazing to us and kind of astounding that at this point. And I think that's one of the things that Edgar was really proud of, and it kind of helps to reinforce his whole thesis as well, that Sparks doesn't have the typical career arc of a lot of bands that have a long history like we do, and that what we're doing now is really as vital and urgent in his mind as anything we've ever done in the past. And so I think this, the whole thing now with this newfound awareness and embracing of Sparks, it really, Edgar is probably really just incredibly happy about it.
Yeah, but hold on a second. You've also destroyed one of the great things about Sparks, possibly, because we learn an awful lot about Sparks here, mostly that you like the air of mystery that surrounds you. Now, there's some kind of a contradiction there, is there?
Well, I think that Edgar did a really good job. We discussed that with Edgar from the onset about, you know, whether, you know, we would be giving away too much of the kind of aura that had been surrounding the band, where people don't know that much about the band. But Edgar, he reassured us. He said, well, you're going to have more mystique after this documentary than you have had before it. So we took him on his word, and we think he did a good job of revealing just enough, but without giving away sort of everything.
Yeah, there are so many things that we learn from this movie. It's so whimsical and sort of intelligent and subversive, and it's just endearingly, zanily, crazily mad. And that you don't like to repeat yourselves. I've certainly come across that with the 25 albums. But one thing I want to just hone in on, one little bit that I found, wow. I mean, obviously there's loads of bits I knew nothing about, thinking I knew a bit about Sparks. You went to the Beatles twice. Sorry, but that little bit is just amazing. Your mother drove you to Vegas. Ron or somebody, tell me about that.
Oh, it was incredible, because, you know, usually a parent would kind of squash down any desires by somebody, especially at that time, to be indoctrinated by these evil British people coming, you know, to kind of warp their young, pristine lads. But our mother actually encouraged us to go to both to the Los Angeles show at the Hollywood Bowl, and then she drove us to Las Vegas for God knows why, just to see the Beatles in Las Vegas. So, you know, we did see them twice. I mean, she knew how passionate we were about British bands and how much it meant to us. So as the quote goes in the film, that's a mother.
That's a mother indeed, because like this is a whole movie, just to get back into the big picture of it, that we see just how much of an impact that you have had on modern pop culture. And that's one great result of actually seeing the movie, because I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't seen the movie. But on that note, when you make music without even half an eye on the market, which you do you just make music for yourself and hope that other people like it? People liking it is almost a bonus.
Well, you know, we obviously, if you're working in pop music, you hope that it will reach, you know, a certain size audience. But, you know, when we're working on things, we have confidence now that if we do something that excites us, there will be enough people that respond. And anytime that we've had a song that is kind of gone beyond that threshold where it's been massively big, then it's always been kind of an accident. And sometimes from a song that maybe didn't to us seem like the obvious choice, even a song like This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us, we were kind of surprised when Muff Winwood from Island Records, the producer of Come On to My House, thought that should be the single. And we were the conservative ones in that situation, because we felt that it was kind of too, even for us, strange as a single. But thankfully, we were proven wrong.
The name of the movie, The Sparks Brothers. You don't like to be called The Sparks Brothers. I know that because you're Ron and Russell Mayall. Great, says Eckhart. They don't like to be called The Sparks Brothers. Let's call it The Sparks Brothers. But that really is.
Yeah, you know, Edgar liked the fact. It was actually a longer story of why we didn't like that name. To our, the original label we were with was Bearsville Records. It was Todd Rundgren's label, who was the first person to sign Sparks. And it was also co-owned by Albert Grossman, who was Bob Dylan's manager at the time. And the band had originally been called Half Nelson. And they released the name, released the album under the name Half Nelson. And it didn't reach a huge audience. So, but he really loved the music, Albert Grossman. And he said maybe it's the name is just too obscure. So he thought we reminded him of we were funny in a certain way, like the Marx Brothers. He said you should be the Sparks Brothers, and we thought it was just really corny, that name. So we lopped off. We said, well, how about if we meet you halfway and we'll chop off the brothers bit and then keep the Sparks bit. And so to this day, you know, Edgar thinks that that's the, that we hated the name Sparks Brothers. He, in his typical style, he said, I want to call the movie the Sparks Brothers. And we said, oh God, isn't there, you don't have any better name than that. And he says, no, that's great. Let's call it the Sparks Brothers. And so, so anyway, he likes the fact that it irks us so much that that's the title of the
movie.
The
more we protested, the more adamant he was to be the title.
Of course, of course. Obviously, as mischievous as he is. The thing about the band and the sound is, somebody says, like, a very all-American, un-American band. Sparks are a lot of things Americans don't seem to care for. There is an element of that, isn't there, about like who Sparks has been down through the years?
I think so, because in particular with popular music, that a band has to appear to be, I don't know, like reflective and kind of sober, and that the physical side of a performance has to be downplayed, because that obviously is trying to hide a lack of musicality in what you're doing. And we never saw things that way. And I think that is the main reason why our first success was outside of the U.S., that there was an audience that in America we were having, you know, six waitresses at the Whiskey A Go-Go coming to see us play, and that completely changed when we switched continents.
Well, do you think in some ways that this movie shows me something which I don't normally see when I see brothers in a band? It is a celebration of brotherhood. Look at Oasis, look at the Kinks, look at the Everlys. Look at half, you know, you're not supposed to get on. You're doing it the wrong way, folks.
No, I know we've done it all wrong, but somehow it's worked. And I, you know, it's just we actually don't see how those other brother acts don't get along so well, you know. And I think it's, you know, part of it is that we, our positions within the band don't overlap. That you know, I'm happy that Ron has chosen to be the primary songwriter for the band, and he doesn't want to be the lead singer of the band. And so I think that our roles don't overlap, and that we both have just a real common, you know, kind of viewpoint on what we should be doing musically, and almost kind of how this unspoken kind of mission to get across doing music that we think is you know, sometimes missing in the pop music world now, like that there's maybe a lack of adventuresomeness in music at the moment. And we feel if we don't hear what we want to be hearing on the radio, then we have to do it in our own world and do that music that we feel is missing. And so that's what we kind of have this unspoken mission, but I think that's what's kind of held together as brothers.
Well, then, do you ever think that in terms of the 25 albums, all of which get a look in some way here, which is brilliant, that you sit down and say, look, it would be nice to get some recognition about things. For instance, Giorgio Moroder, number one in heaven, synth heavy, dance pop, etc. When you read the sort of history of synth pop or whatever, you don't necessarily get the full chapter you deserve. Do you even get a mention?
Well, you know, we feel that one of the pleasures of the documentary is that other people are now kind of mentioning the true historical importance of some of the albums. And so we feel uncomfortable, kind of, we come across as defensive if we're kind of stating the things that you're mentioning, but having people like, you know, the New Order people or Neil Gaiman or, you know, people from all different fields kind of trying to right the historical wrongs of the past. You know, we're comfortable listening to those people in the documentary.
Okay, well, Ron and Russell, thank you so much for talking to us on the program today. And watch yourself. This documentary is going to bring you massive overnight success. I hope you can take it. Good luck.
Thank you.
Easy, folks.
I'll prepare myself.
Thank you.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.